Welcome to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu, brought to you by BAE Systems. Each week, Jared will speak one-on-one with Department of Defense senior managers discussing policies and programs affecting warfighters and how the military meets its mission. On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening to On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Glad you're with us this week. We're going to spend the bulk of the hour this time around on some new research into the future of defense spending over the next few years. The source is the major professional consulting firm Deloitte. They've just published their Global Defense Outlook. And the upshot is that while defense spending by the United States and virtually all other countries with high per capita income shot upward in the decade after the September 11th attacks, we're at the beginning of an era of decreased spending by all those countries, not just the U.S. And meanwhile, spending by lower income countries is on the way up. Let's dig into the details now with Jack Midgley. He's a director at Deloitte and the lead author on the report. He spoke to us by phone from Deloitte's offices in Arlington, Virginia.
Well, I think we can see a couple of differences in the way the 50 largest defense spenders are approaching the task of balancing national security with economic prosperity at home. It's very clear from the numbers that over the next few years, at least, most of the growth in defense spending is going to occur in countries which we normally think of as lower-income countries, that is, countries with GDP per capita below $30,000 a year. That spending growth change is a fundamental change from the past decade, when the U.S. and the allied countries drove defense spending north during a period of a fairly intense conflict. So that's the first big change that we see. The second is a continued trend, a long-term trend, toward denuclearization, which surprises some people because Iran and North Korea are so much in the news. But when we look at the numbers, the story is very clear. Nuclear weapons continue to be less relevant rather than more, and the nuclear states continue to deploy fewer operational warheads year over year. The third big change, which surprised us a little, I think, is the declining emphasis on general purpose forces, that is, traditional large formations, tanks, principal surface combatants in the Navy, and fighter aircraft. Countries are spending more on defense, but they're buying fewer of those systems. The fourth big change is the rise of special operations forces. As the general purpose forces decline, investment is switching in the direction of SOF. That's happening worldwide, and it's particularly apparent in a couple of the top 50 countries. The fifth and final big trend that we see is the rise of cyber as a military operational domain. Current news is dominated by the U.S.-China dialogue about cyber, but the fact is that about half of the top 50 defense spenders have publicly announced military cyber programs. We see that as an area that's going to continue to grow over the next years as the threats become more complex and as nations have different abilities to respond. So those five trends taken together, we think, are the macro-level events that are going to drive changes in defense spending for the next few years.
And when we talk about large defense spenders, we should probably pause here and talk a little bit about the extent to which the United States tilts the scales in this area, right? Because there are large defense spenders, and then there's the United States, which spends by far more than anyone.
It's the U.S. and then it's everybody else. The most recent year for which comprehensive global figures are available, 2011, the United States accounts for over 40% of global defense spending. That is a total of about $1.7 trillion that all of 50 countries spend. The United States budget is about 41% of that total. To put that in context, that share is almost twice the size of the next five countries combined. Those five include China, France, Japan, Russia, and the United Kingdom. If we take the defense spending of those five countries and add it up, it's a little more than half of what the United States spends on defense. So, yes, the U.S. budget does tip the scale very heavily.
And so when we talk about the trends that you identified, denuclearization, rise of cyber, greater use of soft, et cetera, are we really just talking about the United States because of its outsized influence, or are you seeing these in the rest of the top 50 defense spenders as well?
Oh, not at all. These trends are very much, although the U.S. is present in all of those trends are very much apparent across the top 50. To kind of unpack the U.S. influence, we cut the top 50 into four groups of countries based on how rich they are and how much per capita they spend on defense. So the analysis that we did wasn't sort of the U.S. and everybody else. It was organized around different groups of countries because different groups of countries spend differently. For example, the lowest income countries, a group that includes Argentina, China, Greece, India, South Africa, countries that have slightly below 30,000 GDP per capita and spend less than 3% on defense. Those countries exhibit the same kinds of trends. Spending growth is happening there, even as spending is declining in the United States. So the patterns that we are pointing to characterize that group of top 50 as a whole, not just the United States.
Let's talk a little bit about what you talk about in the report, the period of 2006 through 2011, where defense spending was rising. What drove that, and what caused what you're seeing as a turnaround?
Well, we think that the main driver of defense spending in that period was the U.S. presence in Afghanistan and Iraq, which pulled defense spending north very sharply in the United States. But spending across the top 50 grew by about 20% in that period, 22% between 2006 and 2012. That's a pretty substantial increase, paced primarily by rising personnel costs in the United States, but also by rising personnel costs in the rest of the top 50. Your listeners might be surprised to hear that even the Chinese are pointing out that personnel costs, rather than systems acquisitions, are what's driving their defense budgets north.
That is really interesting.
The Chinese are talking about adding social safety net programs for military members. They're talking about having to increase wages because in China, the kind of talent that they want to keep in the military long term is being attracted by private and state-owned industries in China, which can pay a higher wage. So if like the Chinese, one is interested in building, for example, a technical capability like cyber, the plain fact is that human capital is not going to be available unless it's paid. So just as we're facing these challenges in the United States, the Europeans are dealing with it, the Germans dealing with it, the Chinese are all dealing with rising personnel costs. That's why you see budgets going north while acquisition of major systems is going south. Spending goes up 22% between 2006 and 2012, but in the same year, end strength across the top 50 drops by 11%. What explains that is that we're spending more to keep fewer, presumably higher skilled, people on active duty. It's a big change. It's a really fundamental shift from the days when conscription and low wages characterized the militaries in the top 50.
Back on China, you have this axis between lower income economizers, higher income economizers, et cetera, et cetera. You classify China as a lower income economizer. Given the costs that they're now looking at, are they destined to move out of that category and move into, you know, a lower income, high spending country in the near future?
We don't see it. The line between the spenders and economizers is the line at 3% of GDP to defense, and that is a very, very tough margin to crack. The Chinese military does not plan to increase spending above the 3% of GDP line. When you think about the other programs that the Chinese are engaged in now, including, if you look at the current headlines, the move to bring almost a quarter of a billion people from the countryside into the cities over the next decade or so, the Chinese are challenged to spend in many different areas, and they are simply not spending at the same rate on defense as the countries that we characterize as spenders, which take a very large share of GDP and put it to defense. To be more specific, to reach the category of even the lower income spenders, countries would have to be spending between 4.5 and 4.7% of GDP on defense, and no one believes that the Chinese are going to be anywhere near that level in the next couple of years. They loom large in our minds because of the cyber capability that gets so much headline, and because of spectacular programs like the aircraft carrier and the Chinese space program. But the plain fact is that as a share of their income, the Chinese spend much less on defense than the United States, Singapore, even Colombia, Iraq, or Russia.
That's Jack Midgley, a director at Deloitte Consulting and the lead author of the report we're discussing on trends in global defense spending. We'll talk more after a quick break. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbia. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DoD. Continuing our discussion now on global defense spending with Jack Midgley. He's a director at Deloitte and the lead author of a brand new report on that very topic called The Global Defense Outlook. Before the break, we were talking about the report's delineation between countries who are spenders on defense at the moment and those who are, as the report puts it, economizers.
One of the ways you draw the line between economizers and spenders, besides percent of GDP spent on defense, is the amount of money spent per active service member. The higher income economizers, as you categorize them, I mean it's basically a list of our allies, Western high income countries, Australia, Denmark, Finland, the UK, Norway, Spain, et cetera. The amount spent per active duty service member in that category, according to your report, average of $242,000. The higher income spenders is $404,000. How do those higher income economizers in those Western developed countries get away with running militaries and spending so much less per active duty service member?
Well, the answer is very, very clear. Behind the very high level of spending per active service member in the high-income spenders that include the United States, is a huge capital spending and research and development base. So the fixed cost associated with the U.S. defense establishment, the requirement to pay for and support the amount of research, the amount of procurement, the amount of education, the huge training base, what people refer to as the institutional army or the institutional air force, drives a huge amount of cost. That's one. Two, payroll costs, personnel costs per soldier are simply higher in the high income spenders than they are in the lower income, in the higher income economizers. So that difference between $242,000 per active service member and $404,000 per active service member doesn't say anything about waste or inefficiency. It talks about it really speaks to different approaches to national defense. In the case of the United States and the other high-income countries, it's a heavy amount of capital spending. In the high-income economizers that spend $242,000, they tend to buy systems that are developed elsewhere. They pay less for individual soldiers in payroll and benefits. So those two differences, I think, account for that almost twofold difference in cost per soldier.
I want to go back to something you mentioned a little earlier, which is conscription. Describe in a little more detail the trends that you're seeing there. Is conscription on its way out across the world?
It is on its way out, even in the lower income countries. Every one of the top 50 is moving in the direction of volunteer forces. And it's raising a really profound question for governments. People don't want to have to send their children into military service. That's why the United States moved away from the draft army and toward an all-volunteer force decades ago. Now, even countries that have traditionally relied on conscription, the Germans, for example, the European countries that had short periods of conscription, are moving away from it as fast as they can. Domestic politics dictates that. On the other hand, and the reason for the dilemma, if we're going to keep a professional military force that doesn't rely on low-cost conscription, that drives wage costs higher, it drives benefit costs higher, it drives support costs higher, because professional militaries require a higher quality of life than people who are only going to be conscripted for a short period of time. So while we get the political benefit of an all-volunteer force, and while the world is moving in that direction for political reasons, what it's driving is higher defense spending, higher costs. And that dilemma is going to have to be addressed. In the United States, the Defense Department's working that problem very hard with new programs to look at military health systems, to look at veterans benefits, to look at even basic pay and housing allowances. But the hidden cost of moving away from conscription is the cost of recruiting and retaining an all-volunteer force. And that shows up in compensation, benefits, and other soldier support.
In the United States, I don't think there's much of a serious debate about going back to a conscript force. Is that debate more vigorous in other countries, as far as you can tell?
Well, the Germans had to deal with it a little more recently. In our report calls out the German defense minister, who was talking about how the security situation, in his view, no longer justifies a conscript army. The Germans are moving away. So that debate is still slightly active, but I think it is largely settled, even in Germany. And in the United States, no one in policy circles is talking about a move to the draft. We do see some military experts talking about the desirability of a draft program in some limited form for other reasons, some for job creation, some for other social reasons. But the military discussion, the real policy discussion about conscription in the United States is over and has been over for decades.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about where you see spending growth happening over the coming years in these lower income countries. How much spending are we talking about realistically, given the you know, small slice of the pie they make up, and what are they spending on?
Well, the lower income spenders, that's that group of countries that are relatively less well off than the United States, but which spend a heavy portion of GDP on defense. That's where we see growth over the next few years of about 6.2% between 2013 and 2017. Those countries include Russia, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Iraq as it rearms, but also Colombia, Chile, Algeria, Angola, and Azerbaijan. Those are countries that perceive local or regional threats, or countries which have to recapitalize, as you see in the case of Iraq and Russia. So most of the spending growth in the world's defense budgets over the next 4 or 5 years will occur in those countries. The lower income economizers, countries which are less well off and also devote a relatively small portion of their GDP to defense, will also grow, but only at about 4.2%. That includes the Chinese, the South Africans, the South Koreans, Thailand, Turkey, Mexico, Malaysia, that group of countries with GDP below 30,000. But those countries average only about 1.8% of their GDP on defense. So the low-income spenders will grow the fastest at about 6.2%. The low-income economizers will also grow, but only at about 4.2%. Spending growth in those countries is occurring across the full spectrum of conventional military capability, but it is being driven primarily by increases in personnel costs, as we discussed a minute ago, and by recapitalization, particularly in Russia and Iraq.
As those countries do increase their spending, I don't know if you can speculate about this, but do you see them sort of growing their own defense industrial bases, or are they going to is that spending going to filter into, you know, what we have today, the states that are most heavily involved in manufacturing weapon systems right now?
Well, it's an interesting and important question. Pakistan is, I think, a fascinating case study along those lines. Pakistan has been investing very heavily in military R&D over the last 5 years. Now, of course, we think of Pakistan perhaps as investing on the nuclear side, but that's not where the bulk of their research and development is. At the moment, they appear to be very actively working R&D alliances with Turkey and Ukraine. And the reason for that is that those partnerships are going to allow Pakistan to become an arms exporter. And we think that their focus will be primarily on Bangladesh because the Bangladesh is recapitalizing its relatively small military, Iraq because of the recapitalization opportunity there, and Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia continues to buy a range of systems and capabilities. So yeah, Pakistan is moving in that direction and growing spending so that it can become more of an exporter. The Russians are growing spending. Their defense minister mentions that the sharp increase in weapons R&D cost to field new systems that will be competitive with those that are being made available elsewhere is driving an increase in spending. And they think that over the next 3 or 4 years, they'll have to modernize about 30% of the total number of systems. So that's when I say recapitalization, what I mean is replacement of systems that are obsolete or no longer no longer usable.
We talked earlier about conscription as one of conscription versus volunteer forces as one of the debates that you think are going to be central in this new defense spending paradigm. As we wrap up here, what do you think the other centers of debate are going to be that maybe haven't been prominent in the past few years?
Well, we think there are two other ones in addition to the to the issue of professionalism versus affordability, or as you put it, conscription versus versus professional forces. The other two big debates are the following. One is the familiar guns versus butter debate, which kind of got postponed for a few years while the U.S. spent basically whatever it cost to fight and complete the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Well, whether we look at Canada, which is talking about having to budget, balance a budget and turn to defense to do it, programs like the NATO Smart Defense Program, or the current budget debate in the United States, which takes on a special tone because of sequestration. Publics are asking around the world about the need for an additional dollar in defense spending versus a dollar in defense spending for social programs or infrastructure. And our clients and our military colleagues are asking questions about, how do we now construct those kinds of comparisons? How do we do that analysis to justify military versus non-military spending? We've gotten a little rusty at that over the last decade, but leaders and staffs are going to be working those problems hard over the next few years. That's the first question, is the old national defense versus domestic priorities question, which is going to reemerge in this post-war era. The second big question is individual liberties versus national security requirements. And one needs to go no farther than today's headlines to see that debate jump into the fore as unarmed surveillance, and that is drone-like systems, and as cyber systems become more sophisticated and potentially more intrusive. We think governments around the world are going to be asking and will be asked questions by their citizens about how do we balance a requirement, a real requirement for national security and protection against cyber threats with a desire for individual liberty. That's not just a U.S. debate. Those questions are being asked in Europe. They're being asked across the top 50. And policymakers will have to wrestle with those over the next few years.
Jack Midgley is a director at Deloitte Consulting and the lead author of the report we've been discussing, The Global Defense Outlook. We'll link to it at federalnewsradio.com if you want to have a look yourself.
When we come back, we'll spend a few minutes on military base infrastructure. We'll get an update from the Army's Assistant Secretary for Installations, Energy, and Environment. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servian. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for joining us this week. Shifting topics now from future global defense spending trends to the here and now of how the military is managing its bases. More bases than it says it needs. That's a fight playing out on Capitol Hill right now. For our last two short segments this hour, we'll hear from Catherine Hammack, the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment. She spoke last week at the Association of Defense Communities, a group that represents mostly state and local officials where the military has a large presence.
One of the ways that we are working to ensure that we can provide the kind of service that we need to the Army, to the military staff, is to work on partnerships. And some of these partnerships you're fairly familiar with. The first is our residential communities initiatives, our family housing. That's at 44 locations and represents approximately 98% of Army housing. The initial construction and renovation is estimated to be about $13.2 billion, of which $2 billion came from the Army. The rest came from the private sector. From 1999 to 2012, our partners have constructed over 29,000 homes and renovated another 25,000 homes. So that's one of those partnerships that has probably been out there the longest. Another one is the energy saving performance and the utility energy saving performance contracts. Utilities privatization, or UP, is another one of those programs that's working real well. One of the things that it shouldn't surprise you is the Army, as we celebrate our 238th birthday tomorrow, we've got some pretty old buildings and pretty old infrastructure. We've got old utility systems. We've got old pipes. We've got old plumbing. We've got old utility lines. And utilities privatization has really helped us upgrade and improve those, because it's a lot easier to fix a leak than to fix a break. And so by staying on top of utilities privatization and doing partnering with some of the communities and with the private sector, that has helped us avoid costs. The privatized Army lodging is another program that we are just about completing the initial phase. And that is the lodging that has been on Army bases for a long time to provide a place for soldiers who are training, or for those in transition, or for visitors who come to the base to stay on the base so that they can get to the business of the base versus staying out in the community and having to transit back and forth. The third area that we're really expanding right now, the last area we're expanding, is power purchase arrangements. And that is another partnership where the private sector comes in and installs an alternative energy system on the base, whether it's solar or wind or biomass, where we commit to buy the energy from that system for a period of years. And quite often we're seeing these prices come in at parity or less than grid power. So the latest opportunity, and I understand there has been a lot of talk about this, is Section 331 from the fiscal year 13 NDAA. And that is a great opportunity to expand on what has been the pilot for this industry out of Monterey, led by Fred Muir. I know it's been a long time in coming, but it is a real opportunity and gives us the authority to partner closer with the communities. Now, we have not been waiting for this legislation. We've moved out in areas where we do have the authority already. For an instance, at Fort Gordon, Georgia, we have a partnership on our water and wastewater systems. Also at Fort Huachuca, we have a partnership on our library systems. These successes, though, did require some intensive work, especially with our acquisition and our legal communities, to ensure that we were following the authorities that we were given and the directions that we were given from Congress. So next week, I'm signing out a directive to all installations to actively engage with the communities on these type of partnerships. We are also working closely with AXIM to put out some implementing guidance on how to appropriately pursue these engagements to ensure that we have the kind of contractual relationships that are survivable in the legal community, survivable to the kind of protests we see almost with every contract we execute, and of value both to the military and to the communities that surround our bases. This is something that we look forward to. We think there are a lot of opportunities here, but we want to ensure that we do it in a very thoughtful manner so that it is good for all of us. If we move out too fast and execute contracts that are something we cannot legally support or that are raised into question, it jeopardizes the future of all of us in executing these kind of contracts. So although it may be perceived by some to be slow, it's not something we have ignored or set aside. We have been actively working behind the scenes to ensure we lay the appropriate groundwork so that we can move forward on this.
That's Catherine Hammack, the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment. We'll hear a couple more minutes of her address last week to the Association of Defense Communities after one final break. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servian. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbiv. Thanks for listening to On DoD. We'll close out the show with a few more thoughts on military base infrastructure from Catherine Hammack, the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment. She spoke last week at the National Conference of the Association of Defense Communities.
I want to talk a little bit about the challenges that the Army is facing. As we draw down, we are going to be reducing our end strength. And our end strength peaked in fiscal year 2010 at 570,000. And by the end of 17, we will be down to 490,000. But if we are required to take the additional cuts, it will not only be in the active Army, but it will be in the National Guard and it will be in the reserve. And that will affect every community. As we reduce our end strength, we still have residual infrastructure from World War II when we were an army of 8 million. When we are working on reducing the army even further, we have a responsibility and an obligation to size our infrastructure at the same time we are sizing our force. If we don't, then some of our budget money has to go to supporting that infrastructure. In the cold areas, we're supporting that infrastructure by ensuring the buildings are kept at a minimum temperature in the winter so the pipes don't freeze. We are also in the warm climates, ensuring in the summer months that we don't have rampant mold growth, so we're required to temper them. That air conditioning and heating is at a cost. And it's at a cost to those installations that are fully manned with our soldiers in buildings that we can't afford to maintain. BRAC enables us to consolidate. BRAC enables us to focus our funds in those locations that most need those funds in order to support the Army. Now, this winter, we issued a programmatic environmental assessment and identified that there are 21 locations that we will be changing our force structure, because when you reduce by 80,000, that's somewhere around 8 brigade combat teams or more. The announcement of the locations of where we're going to removing those brigade combat teams is going to be coming out by the end of this month. And with that is going to create some holes. And those holes are either infrastructure we are required to maintain or infrastructure we can consolidate into. Because each brigade combat team takes up about 1 million square feet of infrastructure. And that's 1 million square feet that could be put to a useful purpose. We also need to think about the conversation, because the conversation here is not whether we need another round of BRAC. Right now, the Army estimates that we have approximately 20% excess infrastructure. We have about 1 billion square feet. So 20% excess infrastructure is pretty big. We're going to be creating more excess infrastructure. So the question really isn't, do we need another round of BRAC? That's self-evident. The question is, how do we structure the next round of BRAC? And that's where we're going to need your assistance. Next slide. A big question comes up, well, why don't you do Europe first? Well, we've been downsizing our infrastructure in Europe. So between 2007 and 2017, our force structure in Europe is being reduced by 45%. But at that same time, we are reducing our facility footprint by 51%, our operating budget by 57%, to align our infrastructure with our force structure. We know how to do it. We know how to coordinate it. And especially in Germany, where most of our force structure is, we're doing it in very close coordination with the German government, so that the property we are returning to the country of Germany is put to productive reuse. One of the bases that I visited this fall is being turned into a university. And if you think of an Army base, it has housing, we could call them dormitories. It has classrooms where we train our soldiers. It has office buildings, all of those which are common features that you see on a university campus. If we do this in a very thoughtful, programmatic manner, these great buildings that are in great condition can be put to a great productive reuse to benefit the communities. If we have empty buildings that sit vacant for a period of years, you all know that they degrade with time. We're not going to be able to afford to maintain them at the occupancy levels or at the level you would if it were fully occupied. So it's not that we need another round of BRAC, it's we have to have another round of BRAC so that you can get the kind of buildings and put it into the reuse in the communities that benefits this nation. We are productively doing this in Europe. OSD right now is leading a combined effort to see if there's any more that can be done, because I'll tell you, the Navy and Air Force are doing the same thing. We are all looking very closely at managing our infrastructure in a responsible manner where we don't have to go ask for permission, because we do know how to do it. But our challenge here is that we can't manage our infrastructure the way that you would in a business, because our board of directors, Congress, hasn't yet given us that authority. We get asked a question about Korea. What are we doing in Korea? Next slide. We're doing the same thing in Korea. We've reduced our force structure by about 40% in Korea, and we're consolidating onto far fewer sites there as well. So by the time we reach the end state in 2017, we'll be operating on less than 50% of the number of sites that we were before. Next slide. So there's a couple of thoughts that I want to leave you with. That first of all, as our budgets decrease, our base operating support funding, our base operating services funding, does decrease. And that's where this Section 331 will come in handy, because we have a need for the same kind of services that are provided in the municipalities around us. And we look forward to partnering with the communities on the same kind of services you offer, so hopefully we can get it at a lower price so that we can work within the budgets that we've been given.
That is Catherine Hammack, the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment. She talked last week at the National Conference of the Association of Defense Communities here in Washington. Early in the hour, we heard from Jack Midgley from Deloitte Consulting about that firm's new report on global defense spending. If you missed that conversation, it, along with this week's entire show, will be posted at federalnewsradio.com. That's it for this week's edition of On DoD. Thanks a lot for joining us. We'll be back next week. I'm Jared Serbu. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu, brought to you by BAE Systems. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.